ear, causing her to startle. "I'm sorry," Natalie said, asking for clarification. The woman seemed to misunderstand.
"Thank you,"
she said, then tipped a bottle to her lips with one hand, grasping Natalie's forearm with the other.
"I mean, who?"
Natalie said, removing the woman's hand. The woman's eyebrows rose in surprise.
"Well, Vanjie, of course. I used to dance there, but we were more than employer-employee, if you know what I mean. We were like..."
She held up her hand and managed to fumble, twisting her middle finger around her index.
"Ah, hell,"
she said, discouraged by her own lack of coordination.
"Vanjie was my girl."
"You mean Evangeline?"
"Course, sugar."
She stopped and studied Natalie's face, the woman's mouth pursed as her raised brows lowered and came together.
"You mean you haven't heard?"
Natalie couldn't respond. If she said anything, this woman would speak again. And if she spoke, she would make something Natalie didn't want to be real, real. She stepped back and began to turn.
"She's gone,"
the woman said, her voice suddenly quiet, but not quiet enough. It was too late. Natalie felt as if an inescapable spell had been cast upon her.
"There was an accident," the woman continued, "out on Highway 10.
Her voice drifted up as she glanced toward the east.
"About a quarter mile from the old Michoud Boulevard exit."
Natalie knew the exit well. A southward turn took you to a long abandoned theme park. A turn north led to Grunch Road. What had happened to Evangeline was no accident, any more than what had happened to Natalie near the same stretch of road. Natalie heard newscaster Katie speak the name Lincoln Boudreaux. She turned back, and the woman leaned into her.
"Yeah, Vanjie and her boyfriend, too. I used to date him, but he took up with Vanjie after I broke it off with him. Nice guy. Pretty, too, but..."
she said with a faraway gaze.
"It wasn't right."
She shrugged.
"Accident only happened about an hour ago. But look at all this."
She gestured with her whiskey bottle toward the bouquets and votive candles in glass holders.
"Vanjie used to look after everybody. People loved her."
She took another drink.
"Yes, everybody loved Evangeline."
She lifted the bottle in salute.
"Here's to you, Vanjie,"
she called out at the top of her lungs, then started crying. Natalie could feel the spinning of the earth pressing her against its surface, like one of those carnival rotor rides the moment before the floor drops away. She felt sick to her stomach. She turned away from the woman and started walking, then running toward the river. Her breath came more quickly. The perspiration broke out on her forehead, but no matter how fast she ran, she couldn't escape the stench of smoke. It rode her skin. It twined through her hair. It brought her back to the horrors at the burning of the Wicker Man. She had watched the torches touch down. A man's laughter, full of pride and triumph, had filled the air as the flames shot high, though the laugh had slid seamlessly into fearful animal shrieks. Emile had clutched her in an icy, unyielding grip until a shadow had swooped in from overhead. It snatched Emile up and away, his curses ringing out over the stunned gathering as the demon carried him alive into the heart of the fire. Then all hell had broken loose. Natalie's mind was filled with horrors beyond what it could contain. The shadows feeding, showers of blood and shreds of khaki. From the far side of the burning pyre, Natalie had caught sight of Alice, walking in her direction, though not toward her. Alice had continued without hesitation, like she was in some kind of trance, into the heart of the fire. And then she was gone.
As the nightmare vision faded, Natalie found herself before Vevey, focusing intently on the symbols painted on the panes of its windows. But it wasn't like it used to be. Nothing was like it had been. The faces that had always gazed out at her, some fearful, some jubilant, were gone. Nothing remained for her eyes other than the flat, painted sigils. Had they lost their power during the longest night, or had she herself moved to a different frequency, one that left her incapable of recognizing the forces embodied by the symbols? There was nothing for her here now, neither fear nor comfort. Natalie caught sight of her own reflection playing hide-and-seek with her through the vives. She began to scream, the sound turning deep and guttural as rage seeped up through the earth into her feet, climbing like sap through her legs, through her core, and finally releasing itself through her mouth. The world spun around her again, and the longest night was done. Somehow, the world had decided to lurch forward into another day. She stood on Decatur Street, grasping the bars of the locked gates of Jackson Square. She heard the Mississippi flowing a couple of hundred feet behind her, whispering its never-ending story beneath the honking of horns and the banging of garbage trucks, adding its own ancient perfume to the aroma of deep-fried dough and the scent of diesel fumes. The sky in the distance was blue, but patchy fog still filled the park, blurring, although not erasing, the palmettos and the statue of Jackson on horseback, as well as the lower half of the cathedral. Natalie watched on as four crows rose up from the foggy ground and took together to the sky. The light of the rising sun caught them, setting them ablaze, their wingtips catching first, their own wings fanning the flames as they flapped harder, rose higher. They circled overhead, rising and diving like kids playing tag. Natalie sensed no pain, no fear. If anything, they seemed happy. The wind rose, lifting them higher, and as they fell away to ash, Natalie felt a sense of peace, of a long-hoped-for release. Their happiness was infectious, and Natalie felt her own heart lightening. Something fell from above, landing a foot inside the gate. Natalie knelt and reached through the bars to catch hold of the object. She drew it out between them. She held a necklace, like from a child's playset, made of plastic with fake gold plating and plastic crystals resembling diamonds and emeralds. Natalie gazed up from the necklace to the rising sun, her eyes fixed on its brightness, its shadow image tattooed on her eyelids when she blinked. She felt a hand on her shoulder and dropped the toy necklace. "Come with me," Alice said, taking her hand. "I've been looking for you." Alice lifted her hand and kissed it, her warm brown eyes never releasing Natalie's own. "From the beginning." Epilogue. April 30. Hoping to beat the crush and inevitable confusion at the canal and Carondelet stop, Fleur excused herself to her fellow passengers, then squeezed between the streetcar's mahogany bench-style seats, making her way to the door. She held an oversized shopping bag filled with sample linens in each hand. The riders were mostly tourists, for whom the short St. Charles line ride was both an adventure and a slight disappointment. Always expecting more, they tended to rise slowly and clog the aisle once the streetcar reached the end of the line at Canal. The rest of the passengers were New Orleans residents who chatted with the visitors, offering directions, advice, tips on the restaurants other tourists hadn't yet discovered.
Fleur smiled as she descended from the car. The visitors were happy to be here, and the people of New Orleans were happy to have them. Remembering it wasn't so very long ago, some were arguing the city should be abandoned. Canal Street still acted as the dividing line between Carondelet and Bourbon, even as it had once provided a buffer between New Orleans's long-established Vieux Carré and the upstart American Quarter, the median between its lanes becoming the original common ground, since it offered a neutral territory between the two entrenched groups. Of course, borders once established will be crossed, and Flore's own ancestors counted among the first wealthy French Creole families to abandon the French Quarter and build a grand house among the English-speaking newcomers. Fidelité à tradition, loyalty and tradition, might be the motto emblazoned on the Marin family crest, but the Marins had always known how to divine shifts in power and had always done whatever they deemed necessary, regardless of what had to be sacrificed, to ensconce themselves in the heart of the new order. Fleur had long felt no loyalty to tradition or to New Orleans, at least not until it seemed that it might all be lost. Fleur had loved the city from afar, holiday visits and anonymous six-figure donations to aid recovery, but never a thought of homecoming. As Fleur crossed the common ground of Canal Street, the bags she carried bumping into her knees, she wondered if things had been different, if she hadn't needed to return to New Orleans for Lucy's sake, would she have come home? It meant something, Fleur reckoned, that she did still think of the city as home. It meant something that Fleur wished Lucy could have loved New Orleans more. Maybe under different circumstances, maybe with more time. Nothing more than moot conjectures now. A young man wearing a pocketed red apron stood on the corner of Canal and Bourbon, scanning the faces of passers-by, the golden fleur-de-lis embroidered on his saint's cap, catching the sun as he did.
"Swamp doors," he called out to no one in particular, holding up a handful of glossy trifold pamphlets. "Plantation tours," he continued his chant. "Ghost tour, lady," he said, addressing Fleur as she passed before him. Fleur managed to offer him a quick smile and shake her head before the tears started. She didn't need a tour. She knew firsthand spirits did indeed pass along the streets of New Orleans, only they were never the ones you'd wish to see. The gods knew she'd been trying, reaching out and waiting, waiting, waiting for any sign of her dear Lucy. For nearly a month after Lucy's final death, Fleur hadn't been able to bring herself to leave the house, as if she expected at any moment her daughter might return, dropping her latest unnecessary and extravagant purchases at the foot of the stairs and demanding Fleur to take her somewhere nice for a change for dinner. The one kindness the universe offered was that the liquor store had one-hour delivery. Fleur was doing her best to rewrite her memories, to substitute in her mind the pious lie she had hatched for the world in place of the actual horror she had faced. The lie itself was horrible enough. Fleur had dressed for the party they were to attend, then gone downstairs to look for Lucy, only to find her lying on the floor of her grandfather's former study. Gone. In the gown Fleur had made for her. Such a beautiful girl. Such a healthy girl. Such a shame. The neighbors had sometimes spoken these words behind her back, sometimes to her face. Sometimes, when her loss was still juicy news, they'd used it to fill the lull in party conversation. "You've heard about the Marin girl?" Sometimes, they had been unable to say anything at all, their own hearts breaking in sympathy for Fleur's devastation. It might have been because the coroner's office was long accustomed to turning a blind eye to any aberrations surrounding deaths associated with the witches of New Orleans. Or perhaps Warren had used his political clout. Or maybe it was only the approaching holiday, and the coroner didn't want to take on any more paperwork than he had to. Regardless, the coroner had identified Lucy's congenital heart disorder as the cause of death and released her body for burial. Within hours of the release, Fleur had boarded the plane Warren had chartered to carry her and Hugo, along with Lucy's remains, to D.C. Warren and Meredith had canceled the large wedding they'd planned and married instead after the new year in the office of a judge friend. Ironic, really, that Fleur had found herself at Lucy's graveside, holding the very pregnant Meredith as the woman sobbed into her shoulder. The galling truth was that Meredith, too, was shattered by the loss of Lucy. Fleur had left D.C. knowing she couldn't bring herself to hate the woman. At least, not any longer. In time, she might not despise Warren either. January followed. A string of bleak and hazy hours, curtains drawn, a single lamp burning in her bedroom day and night. Perfunctory, level responses to the ringing phone. Pots of tea whenever anyone dropped by to see how you're doing. She found it almost funny watching her visitors try to maintain their cheerful expressions as her eyes took inventory of the mess she'd become. Only Hugo understood, for he hadn't just lost Lucy. He'd lost Evangeline, too. The day after Christmas, when most people were still basking in the goodwill afterglow of the holiday, Evangeline's friends had gathered for a memorial. Evangeline, with her generosity and faith in people, had made many friends in her lifetime. Mourners from all walks of life had come. At least, that was what she'd heard. Fleur had gotten dressed to attend, then taken her dress off again. It would remain one of her greatest shames that she hadn't pulled it together for long enough to help Hugo through the service. He had told her he understood, and he truly seemed to. Hugo would come and go, unannounced in each direction. He'd show up with heavy bags of greasy hangover cure food like Chinese takeout and donuts, or those odd little square burgers smothered in what had to be synthetic onions or fried apple turnovers. Most visits included a fresh large plastic bottle of off-brand bourbon or box wine with a tap on the side. The food sat untouched more often than not. She and Hugo would sit with each other for hours without speaking, sometimes without so much as a greeting. She would fall asleep to the sound of the television he had turned on to do the talking for them, then wake alone to the silence, the television's screen still giving off its flickering blue light, its sound muted. Finally, on a hushed gray day toward the start of February, Fleur had gathered the courage to step back into the world. She had pulled on a pair of blue jeans she had forgotten she owned, and a fuzzy slate turtleneck that still held Lucy's perfume, and headed to a cafe on Britannia that Lucy had frequented. Lucy had graded the cafe as adequate. Not a soaring recommendation in most circumstances, but an important distinction, given that Lucy had failed all others south of Alexandria, Virginia, and west of Annandale, Maryland. Still, as the cafe was situated diagonally across from Lafayette No. 1 Cemetery and located in the same shopping complex as a bookstore, Lucy had branded the place as the Triple B, Books, Beans, and Bones. Going to Lucy's cafe had felt like a way to both hold on to her and take the first step toward moving on. She had ordered her drink, a ghastly cinnamon peach mocha combination of Lucy's own invention. She could almost hear Lucy's voice as she directed the barista. A mocha with two pumps of cinnamon syrup and one pump of peach. The thought brought a smile to her lips. She was able to share this first true smile with the barista as she paid for the coffee and echoed the barista's hope that she'd have a good day. An arriving patron held the door open for her, and Fleur had been happy, though surprised. The smile had held long enough to carry her through that encounter, too. She had almost made it through the outing without incident. She had one foot over the threshold of the cafe when she heard a rising baritone voice coming from behind her. She didn't have to turn around. She recognized it as belonging to one of her neighbors, a kindly old retired doctor she had known her entire life.
"The Marin girl, poor thing. She was living on borrowed time."
Not borrowed time, Fleur thought to herself. Stolen time. Fleur had felt like she had slammed into a brick wall at 100 miles an hour. She dropped her paper cup, and it fell to the ground, its contents shooting out like a geyser. Fleur didn't remember how she made it home that day. One moment she was teetering outside the cafe, the next she was sitting alone in that mausoleum of a house, in the rarely used grand parlor, in front of a bottle of unopened scotch that 20 years ago had cost Celestin, she was sure, more than most people make in a year. She stared at the scotch and tried to steady her trembling hand so she could open it, but then lifted the bottle and flung it with all her strength against the perfect white marble neoclassical fireplace. She watched the bottle shatter, then went to the kitchen to make a cup of tea. After that, she hadn't left the house again, not even for a walk, until this project had come along to save her life. Fleur hefted her bags as she carried on down Bourbon Street until she arrived across the street from Bonne Nouvelle. Hugo owned the building, though it was held in a trust he had set up to conceal the fact he had purchased it until he could present the papers to Evangeline on Christmas Day for her signature. Those papers would have transferred the ownership to Evangeline. But Bonne Nouvelle had remained dark that day, as it had since the longest night. She paused there, allowing herself a moment to take in the transformation that had occurred since she had last been here, only 2 days earlier. The building had been an unattractive tawny brown, the favorite color of its former owner, but no more. Brilliant, bright white had taken its place, and the window frames, doors, and twin balconies had been updated from a grimy flat white to a black enamel. In a step Fleur would have avoided, had she been left entirely to her own devices, the vault of the recessed arch over the center doors had been painted amethyst, and the rectangular inset below it had been rendered emerald green. The surrounding framework of the arch, as well as the rosettes adorning the vault, had been ornamented with actual gold leaf. But what the hell? It was still Bourbon Street, not the Avenue Montaigne. Still, the most striking change was the absence of the boxy electric sign that used to hang down from the lower balcony, displaying the name of the club. Evangeline Casey's Bonne Nouvelle was no more. Although as popular as ever with the tourist trade, gritty Bourbon Street clubs like Bonne Nouvelle had fallen out of favor with the powers that be. It was rumored municipal leaders were making it hard to open new clubs, and harder for the existing establishments to stay afloat. The city wanted restaurants along Bourbon now, nice, respectable venues like the Holy Creole Quaternity of Brennan's, Arnaud's, Broussard's, and Antoine's. And that was exactly what the former club was to become. The gold and jewel-toned display over the entrance was the idea of the new chef, a nod to the King of Mardi Gras, a figure, it seemed, created by his own fancy. Flora had proven incapable of disabusing him of either the notion of the king's existence or the idea of the garish tribute. Hugo was bankrolling the renovation. He'd given Flora a blank check, several of them. He couldn't bring himself to let the building go, but he knew Evangeline wouldn't want the place left empty. Flora believed him, but she also recognized this renovation was a lifeline he had tossed out to her. She had caught it with both hands. Flora waited for a car to pass, then crossed over Bourbon. She didn't have a key to the space. She didn't need one. Whereas 6 months ago, witches had resorted to collecting grotesque relics to prop up their failing powers, now magic was everywhere. The witches who had managed to hold on were now using it with little discretion, tossing it about like nouveau riche, burning through their newfound cash. Once again, it seemed everything ran on magic. Ironic, really, that after how hideously wrong Nicholas's scheme had gone, these foolish power-drunk witches hailed him as the hero who'd restored magic to them. Her big brother had undoubtedly planned a grand entrance, emerging whole from the flames of the burning effigy, but something had gone wrong. A normal man would have most likely been dead by the time he dropped to the ground, but Nicholas's will had allowed him to survive long enough to rise and stumble toward the river. She thought of Nicholas in the newly reopened hospital on Sinclair Isle. A poetic fate, a fate well earned. Still, as he lay there slowly recovering in a magically, medically induced coma, she hoped his dreams were not the ones he deserved. As Flora approached the door, she heard the lock click, and the door eased open. Flora could feel her own power pulsing through her, a vitality like she had never known before. The magic had returned at a terrible cost. The lives of Evangeline and Lincoln and Nicholas's pathetic acolytes. But what sickened her most was that it had returned too late. Flora couldn't bring herself to use magic, though, as with the automatic opening of this door, she occasionally triggered that of others. This magic, she recognized at first touch, was Wiley Boudreaux's. Hugo had contracted for the renovation with the man who had taken over Vincent's company without even asking for an estimate first. Hugo had only insisted on two requisites. The first, Fleur knew, was that she would design it. The second was that Wiley, who had only minimal experience in construction, be placed in charge of the subcontractors. Hugo being Hugo, he'd found a way to hold on to Wiley while still keeping him at arm's length. Hugo had lost Evangeline, his best friend, the cornerstone of his world, and it would be a long while before he'd open himself up to hurt again. Fleur hoped Wiley was a patient man. Fleur stepped over the threshold and cast a quick glance around. Wiley and the framers had managed to carve out a good-sized main dining room and two private dining rooms, one for up to 20 guests, the other an intimate space for two. Her design took inspiration from the heydays of Storyville. New dark oak flooring had been floated over the chipped concrete. The black lacquered walls had received a fresh skim coat to hide dings and cracks. Then they'd been primed and covered with what had seemed like endless coats of ivory paint. Wiley had sourced an exquisite period Brunswick mahogany bar with a brass footrest, a dentelled cornice, and an original back mirror, flanked by columns with intricately carved capitals. Flora wouldn't have a hand in the installation of the new kitchen. The chef himself would be seeing to those details. From what she could make out by craning her neck, he'd better get a move on, as the restaurant was scheduled for a soft opening on Independence Day. The event would include an early dinner seating before the fireworks, followed by cocktails on the rooftop to watch the dueling pyrotechnic displays shot from barges on the river. Friends and family and influencers, friendly influencers by invitation only. An opportunity to get the figurative, but, Fleur shuddered, no longer literal bugs out. Evangeline had always kept the club spotless, which took more than magic. In the intervening months between the closure of the club and the beginning of the renovations, however, it seemed every manner of vermin and insect and worse, spider had sought sanctuary within its walls.
Is that you, Fleur, love?
Daniel's voice drifted down to her from the upper floors. With the resurgence of magic, Daniel had blazed back into this reality, as real to the eye and to the touch as any man Fleur had ever known, and, given the circles in which she had traveled over the last 2 decades, more real than many.
You know it is, she called back, sounding impatient, not intending to.
She shifted her bags and headed to the foot of the newly installed interior stairway. Evangeline had only leased the street-level space, and until now, the upper floor could only be accessed from a stairway at the back of the building, which itself could only be reached via a narrow, gated alley on the building's right side.
Of course I do, love, Daniel replied. But it would seem rude to leave you knocking about down there by yourself without acknowledging your presence. Pop on up. I'm in the kitchen preparing a wee bite for you.
Thanks to Daniel and his wee bites, Fleur had put on 4 pounds in a week. Her pride protested, but she had caught sight of her own reflection enough to realize she had gone from a disciplined petite to skeletal since last December. Daniel was waging an undeclared campaign to bring her back to a normal weight. The scent of vanilla wafted down from the upper floor, the space Daniel had reserved for his own private living quarters. Fleur continued up, stopping when she noticed the glow of peridot eyes on the landing above.
Well, hello, pretty girl, Fleur called up to the cat, who, if not for the shining eyes, might have been invisible in the gray shadow.
Sugar purred in appreciation, it seemed, of the compliment, then performed a corkscrew turn and disappeared through the doorway into Daniel's apartment. The doorway opened into an enormous, at least for one, combination living and dining room that was full of natural light, thanks to the new skylight they'd installed. On one side of the living space were 2 bedrooms. Daniel had claimed the smaller one, leaving the larger of the two for the children, as he still called Hugo and Alice, for whenever either of them felt a need to get a taste of home. A full bath sat between the bedrooms, and the small kitchen, with its eat-in breakfast space, was tucked into the far corner next to Daniel's room.
Come through, love, Daniel called from the kitchen. Hugo called to say he's running a little late.
I hope that means Wiley will be detained as well.
Knowing our Hugo, more like restrained.
Yes, thank you for that image, she said, trying to sound disapproving, but undermining it by choking back a chuckle.
I've brought the samples to show you.
Fleur set her shopping bags beside the dining table, pausing there to take a note of the postcards scattered over the tabletop. Daniel seemed to be trying to arrange them in some order, though Fleur couldn't decide if it was a temporal timeline or a chromatic scale that served as his guide. Lisbon, Madrid, Barcelona, Andorra, Toulouse, Bordeaux. Alice and Natalie were on their grand tour. For the longest time, neither of them had ever been anywhere. Now it seemed the 2 young women were determined to go everywhere. They'd left 6 weeks ago. They'd be gone 20 more.
What is this, then? She asked Daniel, whose head popped through the doorway.
A wide grin cracked his face.
Oh, those postcards.
His head disappeared back into the kitchen.
I can see their postcards, she said, beginning to flip them over.
The upper left quadrant of each was covered in a detailed description of the place and customs, printed in Alice's neat, careful hand, while the lower quadrant contained the same nearly identical scrawled sentiment. Wish you were here. Love, Natalie. Sometimes the word love included, and other times was superseded by a heart.
Then why did you ask?
She heard an oven door open and close, a pan being placed on the stovetop.
Scones, he announced. Lemon poppy seed and plain clotted cream.
Fleur felt herself roll her eyes, as her Lucy had always done.
I meant, what are you doing with them?
She was worried he'd planned to unleash a decoupage monstrosity on the restaurant space below. She could hear him moving about in the kitchen, no doubt sliding the pastries from a parchment-lined pan to a cooling rack.
A little present for Alice and Natty.
He had hung the nickname on poor Natalie, and she had seemed unable to resist him. Daniel poked his head back out.
The postcards, not the scones. Raspberry or marmalade?
You know the answer is both, Fleur responded.
The postcards? I made them promise to send poor old Keep the Home Fires Burning Daniel a postcard from every place they visit. I'm putting together a scrapbook for them as a welcome home gift.
I'm sure they'll love it. He flashed a bright, crooked smile.
I do hope so.
The smile faded, and he bit his lower lip.
I've had a bit of an inspiration, he said,
his eyebrows rising as a line formed between them.
About the name for the restaurant.
Fleur tilted her head and raised her own brows, a signal to continue.
I was thinking perhaps, if Hugo doesn't mind, we could call it Evangeline's Rest.
I think it's perfect, she said. I'm sure Hugo will agree. Another broad smile.
Do make yourself comfortable, love.
He nodded to the sofa at the same moment Sugar came padding out of the larger of the two bedrooms. The cat sat and looked up at them, issuing a commanding yowl. Daniel jolted.
Yes, it was your idea.
His brow lowered as his lips pulled into a tight pucker.
I was going to give you full credit.
Sugar cut him off with a dismissive mewling and turned away from him.
I have most certainly not forgotten your bowl is almost empty, Daniel said, his voice indignant.
He looked up at Fleur.
I'm 5 minutes late with the can opener once, and I'm never allowed to live it down.
Another yowl.
Why don't you call the ASPCA then? Tell them how misused you are. Really?
He turned on his heel and went back into the kitchen in a huff. A cabinet door thumped. The sound of a can opener biting through metal followed. Fleur took a seat on the sofa, and Sugar looked up at her, her eyes shining with triumph. A quick leap, and the cat landed by her side.
I interviewed someone for the manager position yesterday.
Oh? Fleur said, wondering if she should have asked to be a part of the interview process for Daniel's sake.
Bright young woman, he said, to the sound of clattering plates and clinking silverware. College degree, good experience. A native New Orleanian, even.
It seemed he had found an ideal hire. Fleur was impressed.
She sounds perfect. What's her name?
The kitchen fell silent, and Daniel poked his head sheepishly through the door.
Manon Perrault.
Oh, Daniel, Fleur said, unable to believe her ears. Her parents will not be happy about that.
And Alcide. I know, love, I know, he said. Not to worry. She excused herself with the utmost politeness the moment she learned my last name was Marin.
He disappeared once more into the kitchen.
A shame, really.
A shame that is ours, Fleur said. Sugar bumped Fleur's hand with her head, a clear demand to be petted. Fleur obliged.
I'm sorry, ma petite. It's my fault you were pulled into this madness in the first place. The cat pushed back and stared at her, as if looking to her for an explanation. It's only when I first saw you, a tiny speck of gray fur with that perfect pink dot of a nose. She risked touching her index finger to that nose. And beautiful eyes, well, I had a premonition Alice would need you. It was true. It had seemed an odd idea at the time, but she had taken the kitten anyway. Flora stroked her hand down the cat's head and back. Do you think you'll ever forgive me? Sugar stepped up on her lap and began purring as she gently kneaded Flora's skirt. The cat fixed her with her magical green eyes, willing Fleur to meet her gaze. It seemed ridiculous, really, but once their eyes locked, Fleur found she couldn't look away. Sugar peered deep into Fleur, touching the hurt in her heart. Then, to Fleur's amazement, the cat opened herself to Fleur, revealing her own bereavement. Mama, I know you miss Evangeline. Sugar moved forward, reaching up and resting her paws against Fleur's chest. Girl who shines. The image of Lucy, her bright essence not quite contained within her form, impressed itself into Fleur's mind. Sugar leaned in and rubbed her head against Fleur's cheek. Gone, not gone. As the skylight overhead flooded with warm sunlight, the cat dropped from Fleur's lap onto the floor. The sun's rays touched Fleur's skin, and all at once she understood. You're right, she said, her voice catching, sensing Lucy's love as it enveloped her. I can feel her. Everywhere. Sugar looked up at Fleur, blinked her peridot eyes slowly twice, then turned. With a proprietary purr, as if the sun were hers alone, the cat eased into the golden light. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Final Days of Magic by J.D. Horn, performed by Sophie Amos. Engineered by Laura Stahl. Performance copyright 2019 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.